High this time of year would be 80. The record high was 98, July 28th, 1931. Tonight, cloudy and quite warm. Rain developing after midnight, a low of 72. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy, 30% chance of rain in the morning, then sunny in the afternoon with a high of 85. Quick look ahead for the rest of the week. Thursday, Friday, sunny and 86 both days. Saturday, sunny and 82. Sunday, partly sunny and 82. This morning, humidity high at 96%. The wind is calm. Sunshine, a blue sky. 69 degrees in Racine. 66 in Kenosha. 59 for Burlington, Oakland, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Just about 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for WGTD Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago. He later served as station manager and morning show co-host.
And we are beginning today's morning show here on WGTD by reconnecting with two good friends of WGTD. I almost said old friends, but we won't use that terminology. First of all, on so many occasions, I've had the pleasure of sitting across Nancy Matthews, who has been at the Kenosha Public Museum for many, many years, is now their director of interpretation. And Nancy has joined us any number of times over the last few years to talk about Pike River Rendezvous, which is one of her really special projects with the Kenosha Public Museum. And actually, joining her and me today on the morning show in this portion of the program is her boss, Dan Joyce, who is executive director of the Kenosha Public Museum. It's great to have both of you here on the morning show.
It's always great to be back. Thanks, Greg.
Good to have you here. Dan, I can't remember how much we've had a chance to talk since your ascendancy to the throne, but maybe you could just say a word about what it feels like to be in this position of responsibility and how fun it has been or not so fun.
It's been different. As some of you out there know, I was at the museum for 25 years as a curator and senior curator. And about 3.5 years ago, I kind of ascended, so to speak, to the directorship of the museum. I was fortunate enough to be chosen out of several candidates from all over the nation. And it's been interesting. It's been very different from being a curator, but it's been fun at the same time. The challenges are very different.
Do you still get to get your hands dirty at all? I mean, I'm thinking now of the work that you were so well known for earlier and digging up mammoth bones and things like that.
I get to go out once in a while, not as often as when I was a curator by any means, but I did get to go out a little bit this spring. We did a workshop at the museum, a weekend workshop, and I took some people who signed up for it, and we went out to Hawthorne Hollow trying to relocate the U.S. road that was built by the military in 1832, which then became Green Bay Road eventually, or the Jambo Trail and then Green Bay Road. We did some test excavations out there, and unfortunately, we didn't find the road, which was kind of a mystery. We put in test holes about every 10 meters or so from the river pretty much to Green Bay Road. We put in about 28 test holes, and we could have missed it. It could have fallen in between the test holes. The road was probably around 10 or 12 feet wide at that point, you know, one-way traffic pretty much. But it was also interesting that in 2004 we went out there, and way back where the historic houses are, we looked for a Indian trail. They have a sign back there that says Indian Trail, if you've been back that way.
Right.
back by the schoolhouse. And we actually found the Indian Trail, which is only about 2 feet wide.
So you thought this this full-length road would be a slam dunk?
I thought it would be much easier. Huh. But, you know, you're often surprised when you go out and you start digging. You never know what's down there, and you never know if you're going to find what's down there.
Right. So the surprises can be pleasant and not so pleasant sometimes.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
Remind me, as executive director, I introduced you as executive director of the Kenosha Public Museum. That doesn't really tell the whole story, does it?
Well, it's the Kenosha Public Museum is really the Dinosaur Museum, the Civil War Museum, and the Kenosha Public Museum. So it's really three museums with three very, very different subject matters, three different types of school audiences, three different ages, three different very, very different interests. So it's we have a pretty broad appeal, but it is a large organization with the three museums.
And you get to keep it all going.
I get to keep it all going because I have a great staff.
Well, right. That you absolutely do. Absolutely do. And, of course, one of them is Nancy Matthews. Nancy, how long have you been there with the Kenosha Public Museum?
I am into my 26th year.
Wow. And nearly that long, the Pike River Rendezvous has been going on.
Actually, this is the 18th year for the Rendezvous and my 18th year with the Rendezvous. So I've been there from the beginning, and actually Dan was at the beginning too, back when we started as a small event sponsored by the city, and it was held at Poreo Park on the north side of town. And we were there for, I don't know, three, 4 years?
Yeah, three or four.
And then the year that the Tall Ships came into Kenosha, it was proposed to us, why don't you move down to the lakefront, you know, and be part of the Tall Ships event? And we said, why, sure, that sounds like a great idea. And we loved Simmons Island and have never looked back.
Right, never even thought about moving back. Although,
yeah.
I have to say, the one time I went to one of those first rendezvous at Peoria Park, that was a lovely setting in and of itself, but just not big enough.
It wasn't big enough, and the rendezvous has grown. This year, we're expecting 125 camps, which kind of adds up to about 500 reenactors that will be portraying and basically living the life of people from the mid, about 1650 to about 1850, which was kind of the span of the fur trading era.
Hmm. For somebody who has not ever encountered the Pike River Rendezvous, it's probably important to try to really spell out what you experience when you come there. What gets recreated at this event?
Well, and Dan can talk more in detail about the fur trading era, but what we're trying to recreate is that experience of history of when Native Americans and Europeans and Americans came together to exchange goods and services, particularly furs. Beaver felt hats were all the rage in Europe at this time, and they had completely depleted the supply of that animal in Europe when explorers started coming into North America, realized that there was an ample supply here. The first industry in North America was born.
Hmm.
So we have people from basically from all aspects of the 200 years. We have teepees because the mountain men and the Native Americans of the West actually played a big part of this industry as well. There are wigwams, there are tents, and people doing trades. We have a blacksmith, so all kinds of activities to recreate that period in history.
And, of course, populated by people who do the recreating.
Exactly.
And, of course, that touches on this whole fascinating industry, which is not limited to this period. Of course, there's some war reenactors and so on, and evidently quite a few people who take it as not their life's work exactly, but they devote tremendous time and resources to being reenactors or recreators of this particular period.
Yeah, the people that participate in the rendezvous just love history, and particularly, obviously, this period in history. And Dan could attest to this, being a reenactor on two sides of the story, having been British.
Yeah, I do British Revolutionary War I'm on the other side.
Oh, boy.
I used to be on the colonial side for many years. Now I'm on the British side.
I'm one of the bad guys.
Well, you know, it depends on your point of view.
Right.
You know, upholding law and order.
Of course. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
There's a passion that these people have to share history, not only to kind of recreate it and read about it, but they want to share it with the public. And that's why they're out at these events on the weekends. They're comfortable talking to people, and they're comfortable with people's curiosity and interest. And they like, you know, keeping that information flowing and keeping that curiosity going amongst the public.
And the reenactors that participate in the rendezvous are selected for their passion and also for their encampment and their ability to convey to the public what they're trying to portray. You know, that we have actually a couple of the museum volunteers are very active in the rendezvous, and they portray settlers who were coming into this area in about the 1700s. And Edna has looms, and she does weaving, so she talks a lot about you know, why that was important to her family. So there, people are just so willing to talk to the visitors to the encampment about this period in history and why it's important to us and to the history of our country. Hmm.
We're speaking with Nancy Matthews and Dan Joyce about the upcoming Pike River Rendezvous happening this weekend, August 1st and 2nd, down at Simmons Island. Dan, give us some sense of how important Wisconsin was specifically in this fur trade. I mean, were we the pinnacle of this industry or just one of many places where this industry was active back in this time?
For a good deal of time, we were kind of the epicenter in many ways. Green Bay was a huge trading area. Prairie du Chien was a huge trading area. Of course, the Fox access to the Mississippi River and, you know, the Wisconsin and Weir River. It all comes together and it becomes a highway. You know, you've got the Great Lakes attached to the Fox, attached to the Wisconsin, attached to the Mississippi. And highways were important. And a lot of the early fur traders, especially the voyageurs, are kind of the long-distance truckers of the time. You know, they're really going out with these really huge birch bark canoes, which are really freighters, almost like semis, and packing it with, you know, thousands of pounds of pelts and taking them back and sending them back to Europe. Of course, they're trading all sorts of goods to the Native Americans. You know, we think of them as beads and trinkets and things like that, but it's really much more than that. One of the major things that they traded was cloth, so that they could make woolen clothing, which was much more comfortable and much more durable and kept you warm when it was wet, unlike skins. Wisconsin was really an epicenter for many, many years. But the fur trade is really old, and it's really sparked by cod fishing off the coast of Newfoundland. By the 1530s already, there were cod fishermen from England and France off the coast of Newfoundland, you know, the Grand Banks, the cod. Cod is an amazing fish. First, they're huge. Second, they're easily salted and preserved and can be shipped in barrels back to Europe quite easily. So there's a major industry that comes up immediately after North America is really discovered. By the 1570s, there are over 350 English and French fishing ships off Newfoundland. And what they had to do is they had to dry it and salt it before they sent it back. So they did that on land. And, of course, when they did that on land, they met the Native Americans there. They started trading. Beavers come back to Europe and are going, wow, okay, a new source of beavers. Because, as Nancy mentioned, the beaver hat, the beaver felt hat, was the big fashion statement of the time. So that's, you know, before Jamestown. I mean, that's early.
Really early. And those connections help foster then this new industry, and it, of course, explodes. And does it ultimately end with the decimation of the beaver population or with the change of fashions back in Europe or both?
It systematically goes from the East Coast into the Great Plains over many, many decades. By 1840, we see the decimation of the beaver on the plains, kind of the last outpost of the beaver. As people are moving westward over time, the beaver is just depleted in area after area. In this area, by the 1830s, the beaver's gone, and they're trading muskrats like crazy. Muskrats are the big item. Of course, they were trading all kinds of other things at the same time. They were doing deer hides, wolf. They were also trading corn and maple syrup to get European goods as well. It just wasn't fur. But you see that movement from the East Coast westward decade after decade. And what happens is you see the Native Americans really becoming more dependent on a lot of the European goods. It makes their life easier in some ways, but it's a very dramatic cultural shift. And the real problem and the real issue that goes on from the very early days is a kind of a fight between the English and the French over who's going to control the fur trade. Mm. And, of course, you know, they have native tribal allies, and then one tribe goes against the other, and one tribe displaces the other, and one tribe tries to control the fur trade further west so that they can benefit. Mm. And there's kind of a domino effect as you go westward. While there are many good things about the fur trade with two cultures meeting, there are many bad outcomes as well, the introduction of disease and such.
Mm. And it becomes kind of a political game from the sounds of it.
Absolutely. You know, we've the French and Indian Wars, you know, in the 1760s, that's control of the continent. Mm.
Well, you know, it's sad to think about so many Americans knowing nothing about this early period of our history. But, of course, we're fortunate in this little corner of the world, at least, that that some significant attention is being paid to it. And it probably helps us understand how the North American continent and our own country ended up being shaped as it was. I suppose that whole process, our settling here, might have happened along very different lines if this hadn't been in place.
Absolutely. The fur trade really drove the exploration of North America. The fur traders were out front, exploring the newest areas where they can find new animals. And that really is followed by settlement. And that constant westward movement is important. The fur trade in Wisconsin, really starts in 1634, as soon as Jolliet and Marquette come into the state, and really ends about 1840. And that's when the beaver hat fashion kind of falls out and it really ends continent-wide. So we have a 200-year history of the fur trade in the state that most people have no clue about.
And it's a big, important part of who we are and why we're here, in a sense.
Absolutely. when we were looking at the new quarter with the state symbol on the back, there were several different options that people voted on. And one of them was a fur trade option. We ended up with the cow and cheese and all of that. But
we know how you voted.
I was pulling for the fur trade.
I'm sure you were. Nancy, give us an idea of what people can expect if they come to the Pike River Rendezvous this coming weekend, and if there's anything that's particularly different about this year's rendezvous.
First of all, parking, which is always important, there is limited street parking adjacent to the reenactment, which is on Simmons Island, and it's just north of the lighthouse. It's kind of hard to miss. And there is also free parking in Kennedy Park, and we have a horse-drawn shuttle that will take people from Kennedy Park and drop them off right at the front door of the reenactment. As I mentioned, we're expecting about 500 reenactors that will be spread over a pretty wide area. And there's all kinds of entertainment. We have musical entertainment. There are contests that people can participate in, knife and tomahawk throwing. We have river pirates who will be battling with the settlers. They usually storm the beach, and that is always one of the highlights of each day. So that will be going on at 11 o'clock each day. Colonel Webb's band of music will be playing. We have, again this year, the amazing Budabi brothers who are jugglers, period jugglers, and they are just absolutely fascinating and wonderful to watch, very engaging with the audience, so you don't want to miss them. And then other musical performances throughout the day on both Saturday and Sunday. I will be there in period dress, of course. Holding down the Laughing Fox Tavern, which is kind of a recreation of, we talk about the purpose of the tavern during the fur trading era, and it was kind of the place where you could get the local news, come have a meal. If you were traveling, you could spend the night. You might end up spending you know, spending the night sharing the bed with two or three other people that you didn't know on sheets that hadn't been washed in a month. But, you know, that's okay. We have lots of children's games. We also have an activity area for kids that they can experience daily chores. And I'm always amazed how engaged the kids get into washing clothes on a washboard and grinding corn by hand. And it's like moms and dads say, I can't get them to pick up their room at home, you know, and I can't drag them away from the corn grinding. We also have a couple of craft activities. They can make a beaded necklace, kind of tying in with that part of the period, and also making corn husk dolls. So in talking about the resourcefulness of people during that time period. There are also food vendors and lots of other vendors as well. So if you want to take a souvenir home, or if you're interested in getting into reenacting, there you can buy period fabrics with patterns. There are pre-made period clothing. And all kinds of accessories. The blacksmith is there making and selling items as well. And many of the other reenactors have items for sale at their camps. But if you've never experienced a buffalo burger, this is a good opportunity. We also have one of the vendors always has fry bread. And I believe the period candy vendor will be back again this year, too. So, again, this coming Saturday, August 1st, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Sunday, August 2nd, from 9 to 4 on Simmons Island. The camp will be open to visitors on Friday, but there are no scheduled events, and the shuttle will not be running. But, you know, if you're interested in coming on a less populated day, Friday might be a good day. But, again, take in mind that there will be no musical performances, and the pirates will not be battling.
And we want to remind everybody that this event is absolutely free.
Absolutely free. And this is sponsored by the City of Kenosha, the Parks Division. We work very closely with them, the Kenosha Public Museum, and private reenactors who really do a big bulk of the work in scheduling the reenactors and checking them in and making sure everybody's got firewood and ice and all the modern conveniences that they need.
That make it possible. And if people want more information about this and other events associated with the museum, I think the phone number is 653-4140.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
I'm impressed.
And otherwise, your website is
www.kenoshapublicmuseum.org, or you can go to the City of Kenosha's website and check under events.
Excellent. Nancy Matthews, Director of Interpretation, and Dan Joyce, the Executive Director. Great to have both of you here. We hope that Mother Nature is kind to the Pike River Rendezvous this year and that a lot of people will turn out for this wonderful event. Great to have you here on The Morning Show.
Thanks for the opportunity, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.
It's important that you not misunderstand the intriguing title of the book that we're going to talk about on today's morning show. The title is How to Raise a Wild Child. The subtitle, though, clarifies what we're talking about. The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. It is really the life's mission of Scott Sampson to help children to fall in love with the world of nature around them, and to have a hunger to seek it out if they happen to live someplace where what we think of as the natural world is not easily at hand. And Scott Sampson has worked tirelessly on this mission in a number of different ways, as a paleontologist, a lecturer on science, as a staff member of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, where he is vice president of research and collections and chief curator. And perhaps you have enjoyed him in his work on the PBS television series Dinosaur Train. And he has all kinds of other impressive items on his resume as well. And now this book from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again called How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. Scott Sampson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure.
It's a really great book, and you give us a lot of intriguing ideas about how to think about this. And I wonder if you could just say a word about sort of the restless way in which you have explored all kinds of different ways to do this in your own professional life, even though it has meant at certain times uprooting yourself from really wonderful positions to seek out even more new adventures in this respect.
Well, at one time not that many years ago, I was a tenured professor at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, teaching about dinosaurs to graduate students, etc. But I realized that we are at this critical moment in time, and we have maybe a generation to turn things around, both for us and for the environment. And this disconnect from nature was critical, and so I started to explore ways to get into that. Dinosaur Train and a TV show might seem an odd way to do it, but if that's where the eyeballs are, I thought, well, maybe we could do something in that realm. And at the end of every episode, I say, get outside, get into nature, and make your own discoveries. I had no clue, I'll be honest, when we started the project, if television could encourage kids to turn off the television. And fortunately, I can report that it does. I've now heard from hundreds of parents. It's been, the notion was so successful that we've geared much of the television program around nature connection now, sort of modeling behaviors for kids and for grown-ups, and there's stuff on the website, etc. So that's been great. And yet, there was something big that was missing. As I went to try and understand how nature connection worked, there wasn't a book out there that described it. Mm. And every city has dozens of organizations that work in the realm of connecting people with nature, whether it's museums and zoos and botanic gardens and environmental educators and wilderness outfitters, all these different people. So I figured there must be some resource out there, but there wasn't. So I attempted to put all this into a single, easily readable place that would just give people tips to do this. I have yet to have a parent approach me and say, I don't believe in nature. I don't think my kids need it. Like virtually every parent says, yes, I recognize this is something important. So the challenge isn't communication about the problem. It's providing good solutions. And so that's what the book is all about.
Right. Although I'm really glad that you take some time to talk about the problem, and you call it more than a problem. You call it at one point a crisis. You say in the preface of the book, the present day gap between kids and nature emerges as one of the greatest and most overlooked crises of our time, threatening people and countless other species. And I mean, those are alarming words, and it's particularly frightening when you think about something being a crisis that many of us are not even really aware exists.
Right. So let me see if I can back that up. First of all, the crisis with kids. Kids today have a series of conditions that are skyrocketing. Obesity, attention deficit disorder, diabetes, depression, that were at much lower numbers a generation ago. One U.S. Surgeon General recently said that this generation of kids growing up today may be the first to have a life expectancy less than that of their parents. So I consider that to be a crisis, the health of kids. With regard to the health of the places we live, if you go and ask 100 scientists today, what are the biggest issues of our time, you will hear answers like climate change, like species extinctions. There's a fear that half the species currently alive could be gone by the end of this century if we don't change course. You will hear about habitat destruction and other such things. My premise is you can't solve those issues unless people care about nature. And why would they possibly care if they don't spend any time outside in it? The sustainability is primarily a local phenomenon. We need to start acting sustainably where we live. And if we don't understand our connections, our interconnections with where we live, and we don't care about those interconnections, then realistically, we just aren't going to become sustainable. Mm. So I think that this bridging this human nature gap is one of the greatest challenges of our time.
I appreciated the fact that you stepped beyond what I think just about everybody is already aware of and to some extent at least concerned about, namely the contributing factor of the digital revolution, that now that so many of us have so many means to sort of access the world through devices, through things we read on a screen, that That's where we spend so much more of our time than we once did, and of course, children particularly. But you say that we can't just blame technology and leave it there, that there are other things going on as well that lead to this estrangement between children and nature, including something which you call the fear factor. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Greg, I'm going to be willing to bet that when you were a kid, you spent a whole bunch of time outside, unsupervised, running around doing your thing. That is the norm for the vast majority of us who are over the age of, say, 30. That is the true exception today, that the average child can reach the age of 10 or 11 with barely an unsupervised moment in their lives. And a lot of this is driven by fear, stranger danger in particular. And the interesting thing, the psychology of this is fascinating, because the chances of a child being abducted by a stranger are no greater now than they were in 1950 or 1960, when all of us were running around unsupervised. And yet the fear is very real. And why is that? Well, there's been media sensationalism of abduction events, things like that. And I'm not criticizing parents at all. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and I face some of those fears myself. And so the key is to recognize them and then learn how to deal with them. So I think that that's been a huge part of it. Stranger danger and that fear is something that we all need to figure out where we stand on. And the other thing is that we overschedule kids today. When we were kids, we'd go into school and we come home. We didn't really have a lot of homework, and we didn't have a lot of after-school activities. And these days, kids have piano lessons. They have soccer. They have extra homework, far more homework than we had as kids. And as a result, there's just not much time to fit things in. Add to that the fact that parents are busier as well, and there's just, you know, nature seems like this leisure option that you can take or leave. And my premise is that it should be more like literacy. We take time to schedule in reading to our kids, well, because we recognize that literacy is critical. Well, in the same way, we should recognize that connecting kids with nature is absolutely critical. And if we have to schedule time for it, then great, let's do it.
I really appreciated, deeply appreciated the portion in the book in which you take time to talk about us as human beings and why, in a sense, our childhood is more prolonged than we might otherwise assume it would be compared to other upright mammals in the world who pass through their own respective childhoods relatively quickly and attain young adulthood. And human beings don't. We spend, in proportion, spend much more of our lifetime as children. We develop more slowly. And, I mean, at a glance, that might just be kind of interesting and maybe surprising, but it is also deeply pertinent to what we're talking about here in terms of our development as human beings and why it's important that children are spending some of that long childhood out in nature. Talk for a moment, first of all, about what we understand about why we are children for as long as we are in the typical lifespan, and how that really directly relates to the topic we're talking about today.
Well, you're exactly right. Humans have this bizarre, and if you look at the rest of the animal world, extended childhood, that when we're born, we're completely and utterly dependent on our parents for an extended period of time. And you think about a deer or an antelope being born, and they're up walking within a few minutes and feeding and all this stuff. We are not like that at all. And in part, it's greatly related to our brains, that we have these large brains that are capable of doing things that no other animals can do. But it takes a while to grow into that culture that we're part of. Excuse me. And humans, the vast majority of our tenure on this planet, about 200,000 years, were intimately connected to the natural world, and they form these deep social bonds, and that's what this upbringing is all about. So by divorcing kids from nature, we're separating them from this milieu that was key for our whole existence. We are we're built to connect with the natural world. It's not a philosophy or a religion. It's ergonomics. We know that kids outside relax more, that they're more creative, that they're more imaginative, that they're more social, and that free play, unstructured free play, is critical for that. That's what we've had throughout our existence as a species, and so it's only been very, very recently that we've cut that off, and we've seen now some of the health results, the obvious physical health results, but we're starting to document the mental health results as well. I mean, attention deficit disorder, 17% of Americans are on Ritalin or some other drug. 70% of kids are on one of these drugs to combat attention deficit disorder. That just wasn't even there a generation ago. And a lot of people think it's because of this indoor migration that kids don't have time to reconnect and just relax and be exposed to this multi-sensory environment of nature. And it turns out that the studies back it up, that kids with ADHD have a great reduction in symptoms simply by going out into a natural setting. So this is something that is part of our humanity that we've sort of cut ourselves off from and need to reconnect with.
At one point in the book, in talking about what you call nature play, you posed the question, why is nature play so powerful? And then you tell us, for one thing, it offers a multi-sensory smorgasbord of seeing, hearing, touching, and tasting, immersing children in a much grander world than can ever be captured indoors, even on a computer screen. For another, natural play spaces tend to be complex with a far greater variety of unspecified props, rocks, sticks, mud, plants, etc., than indoor counterparts. So they stimulate more creativity and imagination. Then there's that all-important sense of wildness engendered by birds, trees, insects, and various creepy crawlies, along with the potential to create special places away from prying adult eyes. I mean, I'm so glad you take the time to talk about it in that kind of depth, because even for those of us who enjoy a walk through the woods once in a while, that doesn't mean we've really stopped to think about all of the ways in which that is valuable to us and can be of such great value, particularly to a young person.
Yeah, it's one of the key elements here, though, is engagement. And too often these days, when we're outside with kids, we're always saying no. No, don't pick up that stick. No, don't throw that rock. No, don't climb that tree. And no, stay out of the mud. Nature connection is a contact sport. And both kids and nature can take it. And if we don't let kids engage with nature, why are they going to form that relationship with it, that deep sense of caring about it? I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the greatest conservationists of our time are hunters and fishers. I mean, talk about engaging with the natural world. They're killing other beings, but they are also some of the populations and communities that care most about the natural world and sustain it. It's because they're engaging with it. So it's important to remember that clothes can be washed and cuts heal, and kids need to take risks, because if we don't let them take risks as children, guess what? When they get to be adolescents, they're not going to be very good at assessing risks when they really need to be. So letting them go and interact with all these loose parts in nature is a critical aspect of nature connection.
We're speaking with Scott Sampson, who is the author of the book, How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. One of the factors which sort of goes against this, besides the technological revolution and the fear factor that we also talked about, of parents being quite protective and perhaps unnecessarily so, or more protective than in fact is healthy. You also mentioned the urban factor, the fact that more and more of us live in urban settings where easy access to nature in this way is not a particularly simple matter. I thought one of the most intriguing ideas brought out in your book is something that you actually attribute to somebody else, somebody named Ken Ballantyne, who heads up the Nature Kids Institute, who has apparently constructed something that he likes to call the Nature Connection Pyramid, something a little bit like the food pyramid. And it's probably a really helpful idea for someone who sort of throws up their hands and says, how can I do this? I live in the middle of San Francisco, or I live in the middle of Kansas City, or whatever. How can I possibly give this kind of experience to my children? Explain this pyramid to our listeners.
Sure. It's kind of analogous to the food pyramid, but at the very top of the pyramid is visits to national parks, things like that, that you're only going to do once or twice a year. And then down the line is maybe visits to local parks that you might do once a month. And then at the very bottom of the pyramid, and there's a couple of layers, but at the very bottom of the pyramid, there's just everyday contact with nature in your neighborhood. And Greg, I mean, most people a generation ago connected with nature not out in the parks. They did it through those everyday interactions with the natural world close to where they live. And so that's why it's really important to have that abundant free time outdoors in wild or semi-wild places. And wild is interesting as a word because the notion changes as kids grow up. A backyard with some rocks and grass can be plenty wild for a kid in a preschooler, say. Once you get into middle childhood, kids need more roaming. They need to explore the neighborhood, maybe, you know, run along a creek that's got trees on either side. This is the age when kids used to build forts and stuff like that. And then when kids get to be teens, the sense of wildness changes even further, and sometimes you do have to get out into more wilderness-type settings. But one of the greatest challenges of our time is not just the engagement with nature, but the access to it. The Children in Nature movement, although growing rapidly in North America, is still largely a white, affluent movement, and we need to make it a movement for all kids, no matter what their family income and no matter what their skin color. And so part of the challenge here is going to be rewilding our cities, renaturing our cities. Turns out that it's not difficult, that anybody can do it. It's just a matter of planting native plants that attract native insects, which in turn attract native birds and other animals. There's a wonderful book called Bringing Nature Home by Doug Tallamy that really documents the science behind this and the practicalities of it. And this is something that we can all do, but it's going to take collaboration between organizations, too, to think about bringing these types of practices to underserved communities as well.
By the way, I don't think we've yet touched on the fact that often in your book, as you are talking about this, you're not just talking about this in terms of loving nature, looking at pretty things, looking at pretty scenery or whatever, but you also talk about a sense of place, and that's one of the things that has been so severely compromised, is our sense of place. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, right now, humanity is effectively displaced, particularly in the developed world, that we don't really have a sense of place. We drive our vehicles, which separate us from nature, through these, you know, corridors of buildings and neon, and those buildings and neon could look the same just about anywhere else. So our places are losing much of their uniqueness. And kids don't grow up understanding their places or how they worked. And one of the things I advocate for in the book is place-based education, which is a super powerful notion of focusing the learning on local place, and not just nature, but culture as well. And the goal here is to get kids understanding where they live. One of the great tragedies of modern education is that you could be in a classroom in, you know, Seattle or Los Angeles or New York or Tulsa and be learning exactly the same things. And it's no wonder kids feel disengaged from the learning. When they step outside the school, they don't see any relevance of that learning to their lives. Well, what if the bulk of the learning was re-engineered so that it affected their understanding of place, that they understood the history of that place and the ecology of that place and how it works and how artists work in that place, and they had those experiences? What if the schoolyard was turned into a living ecosystem that represented the local habitat with plants and animals from that place, and they understood sustainability in terms of saving the local watershed and creating recycling programs and working with local community businesses and that could be a powerful way of rethinking how we do education. And I think the notion of place is at the heart of that.
Hmm. Your book is loaded with all kinds of practical tips and suggestions on how to do this. And one really remarkable thing you say at one point to answer the question, at what point should nature mentoring begin? You reply, at birth. Right from the start, we need to be thinking about this.
Yeah, I think if you have a baby, try this. Next time that baby is crying uncontrollably, walk outside and just be quiet. And people in cultures around the world have found that just that quietness out in this, you know, milieu with birds and plants and breeze and all that tends to calm children down. And so I think that this kind of connection can start and should start effectively at birth. Having said that, if somebody doesn't really have much exposure to the natural world until they're a teenager, it's not too late. I also describe in the book a fellow from Los Angeles, from East LA, named Juan Martinez, who he was part of a gang, and he was thinking about, you know, a career in that realm and stuff. And he had exposure to the Eco Club at school because he was forced to as part of detention. And he fell in love with nature. And now he is leading these groups of adolescents out in activities in nature, and he's reconnecting thousands and thousands of kids through his leadership efforts. So there's a guy who started late to do it. So I think it can start at any age, but the best age to start is literally as soon as possible at birth, and let kids wander around outside and let them touch dirt and let them taste things. It turns out to be that dirt is good. It's good for our immune systems and many other things. So, yeah, as early in life as possible is a good rule of thumb.
The book again is called How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Scott Sampson, thank you so much for a terrific book and for this chance to talk with you about it. Thank you.
And thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and morning show co-host. It is 8:58. We will join Wisconsin Public Radio and their classical music programming coming up at 9 o'clock. We can give you the WGTD weather forecast for the National Weather Service right now. It's going to be a sunny, hot, and humid Tuesday, a high heading for 86. Normal high this time of year would be 80. The record high for this date, by the way, we hit 98 degrees July the 28th, 1931. Tonight, then, cloudy and quite warm. Chance of rain in the early evening, but it looks like rain is likely after midnight. The overnight low 72. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy, 30% chance of rain in the morning, but then sunny and hot in the afternoon, a high of 85. And looking ahead for the rest of the week, Thursday and Friday, sunny both days, a high of 86. Saturday, sunny and 82. Sunday, partly sunny, slight chance of rain, again 82 degrees. Current stats look like this. Relative humidity now is at 73%. Wind is from the southeast at 7. Sunshine, a blue sky, some scattered clouds right now. 76 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. It is 66 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, 75 for Milwaukee. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio just about 9 o'clock.